April 24th, 1985. 17-year-old Elizabeth Gale Tucker was on her way to a fish processing plant in Nova Scotia's west coast. Her luggage had been sent ahead with a friend. Now all she needed to do was hitchhike her way to the plant. Her mother was worried about the hitchhiking and offered to get her bus money, but the bank was closed and Tucker didn't want to wait, so off she went. A few days later, Tucker's mother had heard nothing from her and was scared something had happened. She contacted police and Tucker was reported missing. They traced Tucker by the cars that had picked her up that day, but her movements suddenly stopped at Weymouth, only a few kilometers from her destination. No one could find her after that, until 6 months later. A man walking his dog found skeletal remains in the woods south of Weymouth. There had been no attempts to hide the body. Dental records confirmed that the body was indeed Elizabeth Gale Tucker. She had been stabbed to death. Her death was tragic, but nobody could predict that this was the starting point for a bloodthirsty killer. Welcome to the fifth episode of Canadian Killers. This podcast will go over the crimes, investigation, and trial of known Canadian serial killers. But before we get started, I must mention this podcast will contain the topics of substance abuse, violence, sexual assault, and use explicit language. It is not suitable for younger audiences. Michael Wayne McRae was born in Collingwood, Ontario in 1965. His family moved to Nova Scotia while he was still young. McRae claims his father was an alcoholic and would beat him for the tiniest mistake, and sometimes would beat him for nothing at all. He often got into fights at school and eventually ended up in a group home in Shelburne for boys with unmanageable behavior. There, he says he was sexually assaulted on multiple occasions. That's when he started killing ducks and birds. He began killing them by hand, but after a duck escaped his grasp, he started killing them with a chopping knife he'd found at school. After he got his hands on the chopping knife, he went on a rampage, killing a number of animals within a few days. Eventually, killing animals became unsatisfying, and that's when McRae decided he wanted something more challenging. He wanted to kill people. McRae was 19 years old when he killed Tucker. Tucker was hitchhiking when he picked her up. He says he was with an acquaintance at the time, but both the Crown and the defense didn't believe him. When she got in his truck, he asked for oral sex as payment. And when she refused, he flew into a rage. He drove them to a private spot in the woods. Then he pulled her out of the car, tore off her clothes, and stabbed her repeatedly, leaving her in the bushes. This horrendous act must have quenched his thirst for blood for a bit, because there's a 2-year gap between his next murder. On November 14th, 1987, McRae, along with two accomplices, Mark Gibbons and Norm Warren, made a plan to rob a taxi driver in St. John's, New Brunswick. When they got into the taxi, Gibbons sat in the front and McRae and Warren sat in the back. They told the cabbie where they wanted to go. And once they got there, they confronted the man, and Gibbons pulled out a knife. It's said that Gibbons saw the cab driver make a motion for his jacket, so he stabbed him in the hand. With the robbery now botched, changing to a robbery and assault with a deadly weapon, the three men fled to the Market Square Mall, and the taxi driver called the police. Once police showed up, Gibbons was found, dead. He had a stab wound right under his heart. The next day, Warren and McRae called the police asking where Gibbons was, perhaps to try to get their attention away from them. But if that was the goal, they failed miserably. The police traced the phone call and found them both in an apartment. They bolted, but after a short chase, they were caught. McRae was able to convince the police that Warren killed Gibbons. Not to mention, McRae only had charges for robbery and property offenses in his past, where Warren was known for his previous violent crimes. During the trial, though, Warren was found not guilty for the murder, but was sentenced to 11 years for his part in the robbery. And McGray was sentenced to 5 for his part in the robbery, neither of them being convicted for murder. McGray would later admit that it was him who stabbed Gibbons after an argument about the robbery gone wrong. In spring 1991, McGray was temporarily released from prison and given a 3-day weekend pass to stay at the halfway house in Montreal, Quebec during Easter weekend. During his time in Montreal, McGray went to a gay bar where he met Robert Astley. They drank and talked about hockey, and Astley must have got quite comfortable because he invited McGray back to his place. There, they shared more drinks and talked. McGray ended up falling asleep on the couch, but around 6 a.m., he woke up. Astley was in his bedroom getting ready for the day. McGray took a knife from the kitchen and marched into Astley's room where he told him to get on the floor. Astley laughed, thinking McGray was joking. McGray flew into a rage and threw a lamp at Astley's head before stabbing him in the head and neck and throat multiple times. He left his body on the floor, only taking a bottle of booze with him. Astley was only found 8 days later when his brother went to his apartment and saw the bloody crime scene. Astley's murder must have brought McGray's taste for blood back, because the same day he killed Astley, he began looking for his next victim. He met Gaëtel Ethier at another gay bar. There, they sparked up small talk before Ethier invited McGray back to his apartment. They watched a hockey game on his pullout couch while drinking wine. Ethier fell asleep, and McGray stayed up all night, just watching him. Sometime in the morning, McGray grabbed a knife and a beer bottle. While Ethier was sleeping, McGray hit him over the head with the bottle and began stabbing him. Ethier fought back, trying to get to his phone, but McGray cut the phone wire with the knife. McGray overpowered Ethier, killing him. He grabbed a bottle of wine before he left. McGray opted not to return to prison after his 3-day weekend pass, but was found nearly 2 months later and rearrested. Here, the story takes a very dark turn. 1998. Joan Hicks moved from Newfoundland to New Brunswick with her 11-year-old daughter, Nina. She had been riding a convict and wanted to move closer to the prison where he resided. Since Mix Hicks quite literally grabbed her daughter and left, they didn't have a residency yet before moving, so they stayed in a homeless shelter for a little time. There they met a woman named Tammy McLean and her boyfriend, Michael McRae. Even after Hicks found a basement apartment for her and her daughter, the three remained friends. On February 28, 1998, McGray called Hicks and said she was having trouble with McGray's drinking and drug use. Hicks then invited McLean over to try to calm her down. McGray was out partying with his friend Glenn Bennett, drinking and doing cocaine to be specific. Late that night, McGray said to Bennett that he wanted to kill somebody, and Bennett agreed to come along. They began looking for easy prey, but couldn't find anyone, so they went to the Hicks apartment. They knocked on the door and saw Tammy. They chased her away, saying they were going to party with Hicks. When she left, they slammed Hicks against the wall and strangled her. She fought back as best she could before she passed out. Then, they slit her throat. Now, no one knows for sure what happened to Nina, but she was found hanging in her closet, in her underwear. The next day, feeling guilt, Bennett contacted the police, saying he witnessed 2 brutal murders and gave them Hicks' address and McGray's location. McGray was picked up and confessed to killing Miss Hicks, but said he didn't kill her daughter. McGray and Bennett spent the rest of the time pointing fingers at each other for Nina's death, but eventually McGray said he'd killed many people, but Nina was not one of them. The confession of the killing of Gail Elizabeth Tucker and others followed. It was proved true by the information he knew. He knew things only the killer would know. McGray was required to take a 60-day psych exam. He was diagnosed with a nervous condition similar to Tourette's, but was found fit to stand trial. He pleaded guilty for Hicks' death, but not Nina's. He was given a life sentence, but he wasn't done confessing. During one of his transfers, he told an officer that he was willing to confess to 11 other crimes. In exchange for more information, though, he asked for immunity and psychological help, but it was denied. This is where I would usually end these podcasts, but as McGray described it, he had an overwhelming need to kill. On November 22nd, a lockdown occurred at the prison McGray was staying at when a metal bracket went missing from a ping pong paddle. At 9:58, McGray called the prison staff, saying he was unable to wake his cellmate, Jeremy Phillips. Phillips laid face down in his bunk, dead. It didn't take much questioning for McGray to confess. 7 minutes into the count, he forced Phillips to lay on his bunk and used the bedsheets to bind his hands and feet. Then he blindfolded him and shoved a sock into his mouth before strangling him. Phillips had complained on multiple occasions, saying he was scared of his cellmate and requested a transfer, but his request wasn't taken seriously. The Phillips family did sue the prison, saying their negligence caused the death of Jeremy Phillips. McGray was transferred to a maximum security prison in British Columbia. In BC, they had a coroner inquest to suggest what steps could be taken to help prevent another death. One of the suggestions? To not give him a cellmate. In May 2001, McGray pleaded guilty in a Nova Scotia courtroom to the murder of Elizabeth Gail Tucker. Her boyfriend, Lanesson, having spent 17 years in prison for the crime which he always denied. McGray claims to have committed 22 murders across Canada and is suspected of a murder in Seattle. McGray is currently serving a life sentence and will be 72 before he can apply for parole. The information for this podcast came from court transcript and Canadian News coverage of the events of Michael McGray.